This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Patrick Buchanan, knows a lot about how the political game is played in America. He was an advisor and speechwriter for President Nixon and White House Director of Communications for President Reagan. Buchanan ran in the Republican presidential primaries in 92 and 96. He has strong opinions about everything political and has a forum for those opinions on the TV shows Crossfire and the McLaughlin Group and in his syndicated column. Now he has a new book in which he examines the global economy and makes the case that it is hurting the U.S., particularly American workers. The book is called The Great Betrayal: How American Sovereignty and Social Justice Are Being Sacrificed to the Gods of the Global Economy. I asked him to give us the overview of his case against the global economy.
Well, I think that the global economy, such as it has been called, is really being constructed for the benefit primarily of transnational corporations to enable them to maximize profits on their investment. And as a consequence of this, what is happening is these companies are shutting down their factories and their plants in the United States of America, ridding themselves of their high-paid American and Western workers, and moving those plants to third world countries in Asia and Latin America in order to hire less expensive labor and pocket the difference in profits. And this is of great benefit to shareholders and executives of these corporations, but it represents a betrayal of American workers, in my judgment, and it represents a virtual economic treason against the United States in that we are exporting our national manufacturing base and we are gradually losing our economic independence and we are losing measures of our own sovereignty. And if the process continues, I think global free trade is really a way station on the road to a world government in which the United States of America will cease to be the independent and free, self-sufficient nation we believe we've always been.
Some of the points that you just made and many of the points that you make in your book are points that I've heard a lot of liberal Democrats make about the global economy, such as that we've lost, you know, the manufacturing base here. Many multinationals have moved their base of operations abroad where labor's cheaper. So workers here are getting paid less because now they're competing with workers in countries where the labor is a lot cheaper. Where do you think you agree and where do you think you disagree with people on the opposite side of the political fence who are talking about the same issue you are?
I agree with them that there's no doubt about it. When you force American workers who, let's say, average $30 in pay and benefit per hour in a high-wage industry, you force them to compete, say, with Mexican workers who may earn $6 an hour in pay and benefits, you're going to lose your jobs to Mexico, or you're going to force down the wages of those American workers. And in my judgment, we have to ask ourselves who the economy is for. And to me, the economy is for the people, and the economy is for the country, and it's not the other way around. So I would agree with trade union individuals who believe we really ought to keep our manufacturing base in the United States because of the high-paying jobs. But for me, it is also part and parcel of the idea of an economically independent nation, such as the founding fathers Washington and Hamilton and others had in mind, who knew what happened when a nation's really economic destiny was in the hands of a mother country and what could happen. And there's another concern of mine, which is shared by some liberals, I believe. It is that the United States is losing its sovereignty and its power of decision over its own destiny. Let me give you a small and a large example. The World Trade Organization says the United States cannot keep out of the country tuna fish, which has been caught in nets that capture porpoises and dolphins. And Americans have a law that we don't want tuna fish, or we want it marked if it's if they capture dolphins in the nets. Now, that may be wise or unwise, but it is our law. We passed it, and no supranational body should tell us we have to amend it. The Europeans, in a much larger example, are about to take us to the World Trade Organization to have our embargoes of Libya and of Iran declared illegal and in violation of World Trade Organization rules. Now, I believe a sovereign nation has a right to make these decisions of its own. I mean, we have that embargo on Libya because Colonel Gaddafi, we believe, is responsible for the murder of those kids over Lockerbie and Pan Am 107. Those are our decisions, And no one has a right to veto or cancel those decisions or declare them inoperative or in violation of some international law. So I think we're moving in the wrong direction in terms of surrendering independence and sovereignty, our manufacturing base, and basically selling out the working men and women of this country who depend primarily on good manufacturing industrial jobs as their way station to the American dream.
Now, tell me more where you think you disagree with liberals.
Well, many feel that we ought to use the trade agreements ourselves to impose our own idea of how an economy should be run in Africa, for example. Here I agree with Nelson Mandela. He said, how we run the South African economy is our own business. And yet in this sub-Sahara trade agreement, we offer free trade to nations, but you must do X, Y, and Z. It seems to me the idea of it is sort of economic imperialism for us to be telling other countries how they ought to conduct their affairs. I believe in a free market in the United States. I have libertarian views about how the U.S. economy should be run, but how other countries manage their affairs is their own business.
You used to be a free trader. Now you're calling for certain protections. What made you change your mind?
Well, I went around this country and I saw that I saw the hardship being imposed on communities and towns and neighborhoods. I saw plants being shut down. I went up to New Hampshire, up in the North Country, and I walked along a line of factory workers and who had just been laid off or whose friends had just been laid off. And one of them said to me, looked up and said, "Save our jobs. There are people, mainly those running these transnational corporations, who quite frankly don't care much about countries anymore, including their own country, and they certainly don't care about workers. To them, workers are really factors of production. They're not citizens or friends or neighbors. And I think this attitude is going to be fatal to the Republican Party on a political level, and I think it's wrong for the country."
Patrick Buchanan is my guest, and his new book is called The Great Betrayal: How American Sovereignty and Social Justice Are Being Sacrificed to the Gods of the Global Economy. We're recording this interview the day before you're going to New Hampshire. Is this a sign that you are flirting with running for the nomination again, the presidential nomination of the Republican Party?
No, my friend, it's a sign I want to sell my book where my friends are. And New Hampshire is clearly, I have a lot of friends in New Hampshire. I haven't been up there. I enjoy being there. It's 60 miles up the road from Boston. And clearly I'll be there mainly to sell the book, but I'm going to say hi to the folks who helped me in the campaigns. And I am looking at the Republican nomination in the year 2000, but I have not made a decision and will not make a decision until after the election of 98.
A Reuters story says that your friends give your chances of running 50-50. What do you say to those odds?
My friends know more than I do.
Okay. As a pundit and columnist, your job is to be a provocateur. As president, someone's job is overseeing compromise, that is, if they want to get any legislation passed. Do you think you really would have had a taste for the compromise aspect of actually being in elected office, particularly being in the White House?
Well, Terry, I've spent 8 years in the White House. I worked for three American presidents, Ford only briefly, but 6 years for Richard Nixon in the White House and 2 years for Ronald Reagan. And I think I know better than any other candidate what succeeds and what fails in the White House. And candidly, bold leadership, such as President Reagan repeatedly exercised on controversial issues, is often the very best way to lead. Now, when you come down to the final point in a negotiation, for example, his famous 30% tax cut, he found that he couldn't get it, but he could get 25. And so he did battle for 30 up until the final minute, and then he lined up enough votes so that when he cut it to 25, it would take him over the top. Sure, at some point you've got to compromise and win something, usually, rather than accept nothing. But I think leadership and a capacity to communicate and strong convictions, and I think I have these are the real strengths of the modern president in the television age. So I think many of our great leaders have obviously attracted tremendous opposition. I was not a great fan of the presidency of Franklin Roosevelt, but clearly he was a leader, and he took bold stands, and he antagonized the corporate community, and it did not bother him that he had done so.
I'd like to hear your thoughts on Special Prosecutor Kenneth Starr and the job he's been doing.
I think Starr has been doing an excellent job. He does not have great political skills, but I think he's done a conscientious job. I think he's been honest and fair to a fault. He has refused to issue any indictments with regard to the President or First Lady unless he has overwhelming evidence, which I believe is the right thing to do. And I think he's been subject to one of the worst campaigns of harassment and abuse and insult and stonewalling that has ever been existed in any White House in my memory. And I am astonished that the national press is in some cases indifferent to this or even supportive of it. He's an independent counsel. He's been appointed by three judges. The Attorney General of the United States oversees his investigation. She has never once criticized him, and that he should be subject to personal attack, and that detectives would be investigating members of the independent counsel's office and their personal lives and seeking to out them for sexual peccadilloes. I find this appalling. Nothing like this occurred in the Nixon White House, and I'm astonished so many people sit still for it.
What's your best prediction of what will happen after he issues his report?
I don't know whether... My own view is that I think that Mr. Starr ought to probably, if he does have a case of a conspiracy to obstruct justice, that he ought to indict whoever is involved in that conspiracy and lay his case out in a court of law where everyone is under oath and where a jury can decide the truth or the falsehood of the testimony, rather than this endless spin doctoring that's going on all sides in Washington.
Do you think there's a possibility of impeachment?
Well, it all depends. If the president is discovered to have committed a series of perjuries in his deposition in the Paula Jones case, it would seem to be almost prima facie evidence of a conspiracy to obstruct justice and deny justice to this woman and to involve others in a conspiracy to obstruct justice and suborn perjury. And such, I think, would be, as Mr. Starr said, a defilement of the temple of justice by the chief law enforcement officer of the United States. If that is true, and that's a very, very big if, and it's the key if, then I think the House would have no choice but to consider the impeachment of the President of the United States. But again, we don't know that, and I think Mr. Starr ought to be left alone to do his job and then lay his evidence out either in a court of law, which I would prefer, or lay it out in a report to the Congress of the United States, what he's discovered and what he's not discovered.
My guest is Patrick Buchanan. He's written a new book about the consequences of the global economy called The Great Betrayal. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Patrick Buchanan. His new book is a critique of the global economy. It's called The Great Betrayal. Everybody who's been in politics has the phrases that they're best known for, and I think your greatest hits include a few lines that you said at the Republican convention in 1992. In your speech, you said, "There is a religious war going on in this country for the soul of America. It is a cultural war as critical to the kind of nation we shall be as the Cold War itself, for this war is for the soul of America." Give us your update on this religious and cultural war.
I think our side is losing it, to be very candid. I think that it is quite clear we Americans no longer agree on many, many basic and fundamental things we once agreed on. I mean, is abortion the killing of an unborn child? Is a partial birth abortion really infanticide, the butchering of an unborn child in the process of its birth? Is that right or is that wrong and evil? We don't agree on that. Some believe that abortion is really an advance in women's rights and a very progressive reform. On pornography, some think that that this is really per se nasty and wicked and evil and an exploitation of women and corrupting. Others say it's a basic freedom. Even on the issues of drugs, some people believe that that whether one takes drugs or not is their own business. Others believe that a healthy society has got to outlaw and prohibit such things. On issue after issue, we don't even agree on what is right and what is wrong. And those of us who are traditionalists, who believe, if you will, in the precepts of the Old and New Testament, we are clearly somewhat on the defensive in terms of the popular culture and in terms of media power. There's no doubt the television shows and the films today are of such a character that they would have appalled a generation earlier.
And what do you find most offensive in the movies and on television right now?
I think the raw sex and the violence and the crudity and the language and the general
specific movies or TV shows that you want to mention?
Pardon?
Are there specific movies or TV shows?
Well, I mean, I remember I'm a great friend of I'm forgetting his name, the young the black comedian who was so wonderful in 48 Hours and
Eddie Murphy?
Yes, and then I went to see one of his shows and it was it was celebrating this character who had sexual relations with as many women as he could, and the language was crude. And I was just so disappointed in it. I walked out that, I haven't been back to see another one of his films. And I don't watch the shows. I used to love watch Kojak and even Dallas, which was sort of a spoof. But you watch the comedy shows now, and you watch the entertainment shows. And the language is, in my judgment, it's very degraded, and it's crude, and it's offensive, and the jokes weren't even funny when I was 13 years old. And here this is being pumped out into the living rooms of America. And I think that a culture is really like a reservoir. It's the water from which we all have to drink, like it or not. And if the reservoir is polluted, we're all going to get sick. And that ours is a somewhat sick society is in great measure due to the fact that our culture is polluted with filth and degradation. And it's something of which our popular culture was something of which Americans were proud in the 1950s. And I don't think we're all proud of what's being sent abroad now. In many countries, they won't even show American films because of that, even though technically we're the most proficient in the world.
American pop culture is in many ways dictated by the marketplace, and as everybody knows, sex and violence sells, whether you like it
or not.
Well,
sure, pornography sells, prostitution sells, drugs sells, but the marketplace determines the price of something, not the value of something.
So what would you like to see in, say, movies and television? Would you like to see controls that make it illegal
things? Or? Well, I would certainly, I believe that the Supreme Court should give local communities the right to deal with X-rated movie houses and to deal with strip joints and to deal with, frankly, even to deal with the quality of some of the cable that comes into the community. This would not bother me as long as the community decides. I noticed in New York, they're trying to get all this, what was the sleaze of 8th Avenue, they're trying to get it confined to a separate district. I'm very much in favor of that. And I think the best way to do it is local control. There are people that want this sort of thing. And there's no way you're going to stop them from getting it. But decent people ought to have a right to have a decent neighborhood and community without this sleaze, and I don't think it's that protected by the First Amendment. I think people misread the First Amendment when they say it protects, it's basically a defensive law for pornographers and filth merchants.
Now, from what I've been reading in the newspapers, the Christian Coalition has been putting the heat on the Republican Party to get back on board with pushing Christian values and the Christian agenda. Do you agree that that kind of heat is needed to get the party back on board?
Well, the party certainly needs something. Needs some burr in its fanny. And I'm not sure the Christian Coalition is alone in this. There's a lot of us that feel that we have a broad social, cultural, moral, economic, tax agenda. And when we elect a Congress, many of us emphasize different aspects of what we want to see achieved. And what I fear is that the Congress of the United States is enacting few, if any of them, and certainly social and cultural conservatives, feel that their agenda has been ignored, even though they're some of the hardest workers in the vineyards. And so I share their concerns in this area. And I would like to see us, if we're going to lose, but let's stand up and fight for what we believe in and say what we believe in. If we're in a minority in the country and we're going to get beat, we're going to get beat. That's never bothered me my whole life. And we elected these people at least to be our representatives, to stand up and speak out for what we believe in and to have votes recorded and to stand up to Mr. Clinton and the war room and the crowd down at the White House. Not really to compromise and to run away. If they do that, what's the sense of bringing them back?
You said it's among the axioms of politics that the residence of the intellectual is on the left. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like you are a contradiction of that?
Oh, I don't. I've been called a lot of names, but nobody's ever called me an intellectual, so I don't mind that.
But do you think of yourself as an intellectual on the right?
No, I think of myself as a journalist and a commentator and a White House assistant and a speechwriter and a candidate and an author. But I think to call me an intellectual, these are fighting words.
This is a bad thing? Did I sound like I was insulting you?
No, I just, it's just my view that I am what I am. And I would prefer the terminology you just use. I just use.
Okay. Truly, though, was intellectual an insulting thing to say?
No, it's not. It's just that I consider myself, as I said, I'm a middle-class fellow who writes books and does journalism and speaks. And I think I'd leave it at that.
Patrick Buchanan, he's written a new book about the consequences of the global economy called The Great Betrayal. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Patrick Buchanan. He has a new book about the consequences of the global economy called The Great Betrayal. He ran in the last two Republican presidential primaries and says he hasn't yet made up his mind about the next one. Your speech at the Republican convention in 1992, which I quoted from a little earlier, mm-hmm. alienated a lot of Republicans who thought that what you were saying was a little extreme. Do you have any regrets mm-hmm. about that speech?
No, I really don't, because the night after that speech, George Bush shot up 10 points in the polls. Any speech that is memorable and one is remembered as long as that is has got to have said something serious and controversial. And the fact that people still speak about it 6 years later tells me that I think that we really touched the heart of an issue when I said there is a cultural and religious war going on for the soul of this country. I think people apprehended the truth of that on both sides. And I think it explains the hostility of the reaction to that speech, as well as the enormous reception it got across the country. For the first time in a Republican convention, the opposition candidate came out swinging. Mr. Clinton was outraged, he claimed, by the speech, and normally candidates are silent during the opposition convention. He came out, his whole attack room and his war room came out, and I think that pointed to the effectiveness of it. And the fact that Mr. Bush and the Republicans sort of ran away from these ideas, I think ensured their defeat, because with the economy in such bad shape in 1992, and with foreign policy off the table because the Cold War was over, the great strength, as we found out in 1994, of Republicans was their traditionalism and conservatism, especially on moral and cultural issues. I think if the Republicans had stayed the course on that under fire, they would have held the White House.
I think that one thing that gives people a lot of reservations about your ideas of, for instance, the religious war, is that some people assume that when you talk about religious values, you're talking about your interpretation of your religion, your interpretation of God, the Christian conservative interpretation of religion and God, which is different from a lot of other Christian interpretations of God, a lot of other Jewish interpretations of religious values, a lot of other, and there are other religions in this country, I'm not even mentioning Muslims in America and so on, but there's a lot of ways to be religious, even within Christianity and Judaism. And
well, many
people feel that you're asserting a very narrow interpretation.
Well, my interpretation of what is right and wrong comes out of the Old and New Testament. It comes out of natural law. It comes out of tradition.
What comes out of your interpretation of the Old and New Testament is the point, I think, that many people would make.
Well, listen, look, it seems to me that when it comes down to certain fundamental basic things, that there is a right and there is a wrong. And it seems to me, while all of us are sinners, you have a moral obligation to speak out and say when you think something is wrong. Now, that this people are offended by this, people have always been offended when such things are said, whoever said them. And I think I have the same right, for example, to speak out and say that I believe pornography and filth are wrong, that abortion is evil and wicked, as, for example, Dr. King did when he spoke out and said segregation is wrong, and that we have to live up to the meaning of our creed. He was a Christian minister. He said what he saw as a contradiction, not simply of the American promise, but of the Christian creed. And obviously, I'm going to speak out of my tradition what I believe is right and wrong.
But I think that your critics feel that when you talk about religious values, you speak as if all religions agree that abortion and homosexuality are immoral, and all religious leaders don't agree on that.
Well, let's take traditional Judaism and the Islamic faith and traditional Christianity, and quite frankly, the views of all the great men down through history are that homosexuality is unnatural, immoral, and wrong, that it leads to not only the destruction of the soul, but it leads to personal, horrendous personal difficulties. I think this is truly demonstrable. But it seems to me I've got the same right to come out and say, I believe this, that it's immoral, unnatural, and wrong, as in our under our Constitution, someone who is an active homosexual has to come out and say, it is a healthy, moral, and legitimate lifestyle and ought to be put on the same level as traditional marriage, and civil rights laws should be changed so that homosexuals, because of their behavior, nothing may be done to discriminate against them in the workplace. They can say that. They can argue for their point of view, and I argue for my point of view. I don't see what the problem is.
In 1996, you pledged to rescue the Republic from the grip of the godless New World Order. What is the godless New World Order?
I think it's the emerging world government we see in the International Monetary Fund, a UN which is claiming more and more authority and power over nation states, a world court which tries to tell Virginia whether or not it can execute a rapist murderer, and a World Bank which is redistributing the wealth of my country. All these embryonic institutions of world government I think ought to be opposed, and the United States ought to really maintain its faithfulness to the final toast of John Adams on his deathbed, which is independence forever. I believe in America as a nation state, independent, free, self-sufficient, forever. And I do not believe we ought to yield an iota of American sovereignty to any global institution. And I will spend the rest of my days fighting these gradual encroachments on the sovereignty and independence of my country, because I am an American first.
My guest is Patrick Buchanan. He's written a new book about the consequences of the global economy called The Great Betrayal. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Patrick Buchanan is my guest. He has a new book called The Great Betrayal, How American Sovereignty and Social Justice Are Being Sacrificed to the Gods of the Global Economy. You worked for Richard Nixon from 1966 till he resigned in 1974. Mm-hmm. How did you first meet him?
I was a caddy at the Burning Tree Country Club in Maryland when I was in my early teens.
Were you already interested in politics at that time?
Oh, I was very interested in politics. I grew up in Washington, D.C., and we didn't have a vote for a mayor or student council or a Congress or anything. And so none of us cared about local politics because there were no local politics. But I loved to read about foreign policy and national politics and great national quarrels. And I was a very alert little kid. And so when I went around the Burning Tree Country Club, I knew exactly all who those fellows were. And I knew exactly what they were saying when they were yelling to each other. And they thought they were having private conversations.
You were, among other things, a speechwriter in the Nixon administration.
Among other things, yes.
And you wrote the Silent Majority speech?
I think the president deserves more credit. President Nixon, usually with a speechwriter, would go through 8 or 9 drafts, and by the time you got to the final draft, you could barely recognize any of your own language in it. They're all very much in his own formulation. But yes, I worked on the great Silent Majority speech. I worked on his speech that announced the Cambodian invasion. I worked on Vice President Agnew's address in Des Moines, and which he took on the networks, and it was carried live on all 3 networks in one of the most famous vice presidential addresses ever. I worked on a number of foreign policy speeches. I worked on Ronald Reagan's speeches as well.
Did you come up with the phrase silent majority?
No, I did not come up with that phrase, silent majority, but I had urged the president to use an old phrase, the forgotten Americans, in a number of speeches, which he popularized, and middle Americans. But silent majority, I believe, was his own phrase in that address.
And I think for Spiro Agnew, the vice president, you came up with pusillanimous pussyfooting.
Well, I wrote an awful lot for Mr. Agnew, and he loved alliteration.
And what was the context of that?
I don't recall the exact context of it, but he certainly, Spiro Agnew went from, in his early days, when he was considered something of a joke coming in as vice president, to being the most respected man in America, the third most respected man in America after Billy Graham and Richard Nixon in 1969, because of these speeches, basically, which challenged and took on and denounced the overprivileged kids on campuses who were ripping up the campuses, breaking the laws, and in their demonstrations against us and against the Vietnam War, which John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson had gotten us into. And Agnew became the Tribune of Middle America, and he was an enormously popular figure until he got caught up in what was a very foolish scandal, which destroyed his career and his future.
Did you feel betrayed by Watergate? Nixon was your mentor.
No, I did not. I think Richard Nixon made some mistakes, and I was mature, and I wasn't a child in Watergate, and things like this happen, and mistakes were made by the President of the United States, serious mistakes that cost him his presidency. And Richard Nixon gave me 9 of the most interesting, exciting, and controversial years of my life. He gave us some tremendous victories in 1966. In 1972, you recall, we crushed the Democratic Party, 49 states and 61% of the vote. Nixon and Agnew had the American people in the palm of their hand. And it is to my regret, and of course to their eternal regret, that they lost it all because of foolish decisions which were of relatively inconsequential when you considered the great stakes that were at hand. But the greatest problem of Watergate was, frankly, that our opposition and adversaries used it to undermine the American cause in Vietnam. And 15 million people lost their freedom, and millions lost their lives in Cambodia and Vietnam as a consequence of the breaking of the Nixon presidency. And that is the real loss to America, that everything for which those American men sacrificed and died in Vietnam was dumped down a sewer by the people who brought down the Nixon White House.
What do you think the scenario might have been if it weren't for Watergate and if President Nixon remained in office?
I think he might have won the Vietnam War, or at least maintained the South Vietnamese government by using American air power.
Now, I think in a way, defended Watergate by saying that you defended the belligerent politics of the Watergate era. Do you think belligerent politics have changed much since the late 60s and early 70s?
Well, I don't know that the Nixon administration did not come into office looking for a fight. We knew we came into a city where both houses of Congress were controlled by the opposition. The Democratic Party had been thrown out because it had marched us into Vietnam and failed to solve the war, and the Great Society programs were seen as a failure. And there were riots in the cities, and there were demonstrations on campuses. And the American people wanted a restoration of some sense of order and decency and obedience to law in society. And I think, in a sense, Richard Nixon did a tremendous amount to bring that about. And I don't know that it was belligerent politics on his part so much as it was imposed upon him by an incredibly hostile opposition. I mean, when you have 500,000 people surrounding the White House calling you obscene names, I don't think it's the president who can be called belligerent.
Patrick Buchanan is my guest, and his new book is a critique of the global economy. It's called The Great Betrayal. An earlier book was an autobiographical book in which you wrote about your coming of age and your family. And you said you got your political education at the dining room table, at the head of which sat an authoritarian figure mm-hmm. whose political heroes were Douglas MacArthur, Joe McCarthy, and General Franco. What kind of political sense do you think your father passed on to you because of who his heroes were?
I think he passed on the idea that patriotism is important, and courage is important, and leadership is important, and that you stand by loyally by your by people who are in trouble. I remember he called me up during Watergate and one time, and President Nixon was particularly down, and he just asked me, "Why aren't you fighting?" And that was exactly the right question, not to feel, as you mentioned earlier, feel betrayed or feel sorry for yourself, but recognize that men are human. They made mistakes, and he was my leader, and he had done wonderful things for me, and it was the obligation of loyalty to stand by him right to the end. That's what he taught me.
In that book also, you wrote that your father wanted his children to always fight back. You say, while other boys were being punished for getting into fights as toddlers, we were punished when we failed to hit a punching bag 400 times a day. Mm-hmm. What value did he pass on to you about fighting back?
He taught you that you were not in a world that what you might call a liberal world really did not exist. In the real world, you were going to run into very tough individuals and bullies and thugs, and that the idea that you could turn the other cheek constantly was an ideal that you really couldn't always attain, and that you'd be better off in life if you knew how to defend yourself, whether it was with your fists or with words. And I found that very sound advice as well. I think he had a more realistic appreciation of the world than you hear in a lot of talk shows today.
Did you share his admiration for Joe McCarthy and General Franco?
Well, I was only 11 years old when Senator McCarthy made his speech. And McCarthy was gone, I guess, by the time I was 15. I followed all that, and quite frankly, I noticed when I wrote my other book that 50% of the American people supported Joe McCarthy in the beginning of 1954, and only 29% opposed him. And I think the reason they did was that they did agree with McCarthy on this point, that the elites who had managed American foreign policy in 1945 had by 1950 frittered away all of the gains that American soldiers, including my four uncles, had made in World War II. And one of the reasons is because they had been so indifferent or foolish as to believe Stalin and communism were not evil and were not the enemies and adversaries of the United States. And so when the war started in Korea and they saw Americans dying, Americans were enraged at this elite establishment. And I think that rage was justified. And while Senator McCarthy was very, very loose in his rhetoric, I think his fundamental point that the great gains of World War II had been frittered away by foolish men, including Franklin Roosevelt, I think the American people believed that then, and I think they were right.
Patrick Buchanan, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Patrick Buchanan has written a new book about the consequences of the global economy called The Great Betrayal.